Welcome back to another episode. My name is Michelle Dernan. If you are new here, I'm an independent agronomist based out of Huron County, Ontario. I host this podcast because I love sharing the behind-the-scenes stories of great folks within our industry. Today's conversation is with Ken Cura. Ken has been a fantastic mentor to myself as well as many others within the industry. We're going to discuss his career starting out in ag retail to his current role in crop protection and some things that he's seen and learned about the industry along the way. Then we're going to dive into chatting about Ken's side hustle. A couple years ago, he started K&K Wood Co. Him and his son now make the most amazing handcrafted wood pieces, everything from cutting boards to coffee tables, live edge, unique cuts of wood with epoxy resin. And so I'm very excited for you to learn more about that and how he has integrated his side hustle into his lifestyle without taking away from his main career.
My background, really, born and raised on a farm in, I guess, northeastern Oxford County. We always said that we were about $5,000 on the wrong side, an acre on the wrong side of the township line there between East Oratavistock and Blanford Blenheim. But we had a little flavor of East Oratavistock dirt. So, but nonetheless, it was beef cash crop farm. Mom and dad converted that from dairy in 1970. Unfortunately, the interest rate crisis of the early 80s bit them, and the farm was downsized. They went to work off the farm. I still had my experience with, helping dad grow a little bit of crop and feeding the beef cattle. And with that, I kind of all things, I went to, or I intended, I found high school really easy. So I thought to myself, well, I'm going to go to university, and what do I want to do? Well, for whatever reason, I wanted to become a teacher at that time. And went to University of Waterloo. That didn't go very well at all. I was out of there halfway through second term. So I always get asked, because I'm in ag, it's like, well, I don't remember what, like, you didn't go to Guelph. Like, what, did you go to Olds? Did you go to the States? Like, I didn't go to ag school at all. I landed back in ag by accident. I started as a summer student or marketing support student or whatever you would call it on contract the first week of May in 1998. A family friend was an agronomist for NK Seeds at the time when they were introducing the first, BT traded corn, right, for European corn borer back in 1998, and they hit a real growth curve. I was kind of fortunate to land in the company as part of that, even as just a summer contract position. I wasn't really a student, but it was a student role. I did that for 3 years. It was a stroke of luck. I was out of work a month earlier. I'd been dismissed from a job elsewhere, this person had lost his student to a better opportunity, and he needed help the first week of May, which, as you know, is not the time of year for an ag person to be looking for help, right? So
wolves right off the bat.
yeah in you go, right? So learned how to drive a lot of miles in a day, but also met a lot of great people between the NK dealers, some retailers, some farmers, and I really enjoyed that for 3 years. I jumped into retail for 8 years, with Sylvite Agri Services, and did a couple of different roles for them and got familiar with their retail landscape. And then where I met your family and you yourself, Michelle, as a Pride Seeds agronomist for 8 years. And now I've been with BSF as a territory rep in the same territory for sneaking up on 6 years next month.
That's excellent. Well-rounded.
Yeah, it's been, I always say I've been really fortunate because I've had the right opportunities come at the right time. And I've also, for whatever reason, it's not like I haven't sniffed around other jobs earlier in my career in the industry, but for whatever reason, I didn't get them. And as it's turned out, that's been a good thing just for the career path I ended up on. All right. So
it is funny how things work out sometimes.
Yeah. It's been a very fortunate ride.
I honestly like hearing, and I appreciate that you shared that you did start out pursuing the path of being a teacher, because I do think that there is a lot of pressure when you're younger to know exactly the career path that you're going to pursue. And so it's nice, I think, for especially the younger audience listening to hear that, here's someone who's very successful in our industry that started out thinking he was going to take an entirely different path.
Yeah, and I think there's a valuable lesson there too. And I have a 15-year-old son, and I have stepdaughters in their early 20s, and we always talk about career path, et cetera. Failure is a good experience, and that was very humbling, and it was a bit of an emotional beating to go to University of Waterloo and not do well after having done so well scholastically. And we're not talking about marginal failing; we're talking about like you're not, you haven't even made it to the ballpark to play the game yet. That's how dumb you are in these classes, right? I was just not picking up the knowledge and struggling socially with the campus experience as well. And yeah, it was a great day when I got out of there and went to college for just a general business 2-year degree, and yeah, carried on from there. So
I love that. I'm honestly really glad you shared that.
well, it was yeah, it was an about turn on my career path in a big hurry.
Okay, so now your career. So we spent 8 years working in ag retail, the hustle and the bustle. And it's amazing you left because so many people get addicted and they stay because it is fantastic working directly with growers. I can say that from firsthand experience. I did love it. And then you worked in the seed industry for a number of years and are now in crop protection. Can you speak to some of the differences between those types of roles and, maybe some of your favorite things, working in each of those different roles?
Yeah, so I'll start with, my time with Pride Seeds and now BASF. I've always had involvement with summer interns or summer students, right? Generally Guelph or Ridgetown students, sometimes some of the other ag schools. I actually had a student my first year with BASF that came out of business school at Western here in London, which is great because it's a different perspective. And I won't get sidetracked on that tangent, but I think that's something our industry needs to do, is we need to get outside of our ag schools and get into the business schools to really replenish and recruit for our industry going forward the next 5 to 10 years. I think retail, you and I have both been in retail, massive commitment, right? It takes a lot of dedication. Especially for me, I spent some time managing a satellite location, so there wasn't a lot of support staff there. So basically, the buck stopped with me, right? Between myself and one other salesperson, that's really how the business got serviced from a row crop side. We had a specific hort person as well. That person kind of did their own thing, but I mean, yeah, we didn't have a lot of support there, right? There was a half dozen of us there in the spring, getting her done, right? Nose to the grindstone, just put your head down and plow through, and when the phone stops ringing, we can go home. And yeah, it's what I always tell the students to get back to them, and they ask about their career path, is if you're successful in crop inputs retail, certainly for the Eastern Canadian market, you have a lot of vectors to go anywhere, right? Recruiters start looking for you, suppliers start looking for you. You could even branch out of crop inputs retail and maybe move into the precision ag space or whatever, right? Lending shows you the value of relationships with growers, and you mentioned that, right? It's fantastic working with the growers, but it is a big commitment, right? I had retails in my territory. We went through a year of, spring really didn't have any rain breaks, and I had retails worked 100 some odd days in a row from April to early July, and depending on the crop mix in their area, that's a massive commitment. And but I always tell the students, you if you succeed at making that commitment, you a lot of doors are open for success down the road.
I agree with you. And I also think that, I still think back on my first spring when I was working at Clark's, and that was 2015. And that was a late spring on the clay. And then everything dried up at once and all hell broke loose. And I literally still think back on that spring with fond memories just because of how hard you were working. And it was such a team effort. And so I think that it's a good thing to learn early in your career. And I think that it gives you a lot of respect from farmers as well when they see you in that type of role.
Yeah, there's no question when you're available to service their needs, Within reason, because there's always boundaries set up depending on your personal life and the nature of the business, etc. But you're there to service their needs when they need them and help solve their problems. That's a big deal that obviously goes well towards the business and building relationships and getting some personal satisfaction out of your job when, let's face it, it's time of year when personal, you're 91 hours into the week on Friday night or Saturday morning. Personal satisfaction's a little hard to realize sometimes, but that's where it comes from, right? So yeah, it's really important, especially for younger people getting into the business, because a lot happens when we're younger in life. We get married, we have families, et cetera, and you need a pretty strong support network within your employer, but also outside of it, right? You need a supportive spouse, you need supportive parents or whatever to help with, taking care of children, things like that. I mean, it's a big commitment, and it goes beyond just the individual working for the Clark Agri Services or Sylvite Agri Services of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So what differences have you noticed working in seed and crop protection?
Yeah, so jumping into that supplier layer or the manufacturer layer, I guess the best way to describe it is you're obviously working at a different level within the system, right? So you have a narrower group of customers, but obviously the relationships are that much more critical, right? And I look at my move into the crop protection sector, and it's become even more so just because of the nature of my territory. I deal with very few retailers, but they're very large. So for me internally to be successful in my territory, the bottom line is I really can't peeve any one of them off, right? I mean, I have to keep them all satisfied, because if one of them becomes, extremely dissatisfied with their experience with Ken-Kerr or BASF or both, it's really hard for me to be successful in my territory from a personal level and also from a company level, right? They're going to look at that territory and wonder what's going on. So, yeah, I think the relationships become that much more critical, right? To support the farmers, suppliers, to support the crop inputs retail chain, to support the independent agronomists that are out there like yourself, because you're obviously a huge voice in supporting the farmer and positioning all products, including ours, in the marketplace. So, one of the key differences I notice, though, is it just moving through those levels becomes a little bit easier to manage your time too. You're still very much in an on-demand world, but it's not as relentless as crop inputs retail to some degree. At least that's my experience there. So, they've been good moves. It's enabled me to have a little bit more time with my family, and with my son. And the big thing is, just to be able to help people at a little bit of a higher level. And instead of helping a farmer, now I'm helping people help farmers. And that's quite satisfying. And to be able to as a certified crop advisor and a rep for Pride Seeds or for BASF, to be able to execute that knowledge transfer to people that can help farmers every day.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I will speak firsthand that you have been certainly pivotal in helping a lot of people like myself learn as we've come up in the industry. And like one thing that I really appreciate and respect of you is that any grower that has worked with you has got nothing but absolutely great things to say about you. I would say no matter what role you have held, you've been a very trusted advisor. And I think that comes back to, you were just speaking about customer satisfaction. It sounds like that is something that you have really focused on. So maybe if you would just elaborate on a few of the things that you think have helped you to become somebody that is seen as a trusted advisor, whether it be on farm or within the industry.
I think this will sound very strange, but the fact that I didn't go to one of the ag schools and get bombarded with technical learnings, so early in my career, I got bombarded with technical learnings in my job, right? And I found that I had to be the type of person to dumb it down a little bit and relay the concepts and relay the knowledge in layman's terms, right? And but you know what? Those terms are things that I understood and farmers understood. Here's kind of how this works and what it means. Like, take it a step further. Now that I have 20 years experience in my career, like I always say to myself, let's not get trapped in the marketing speak from our from within our company and the taglines and the things we're supposed to say, but let's talk about the things and the benefits that are, the feature benefit aspect of positioning our products and what it really means for a farmer in terms of, how does this fit or where does it not fit, right? And we have interesting jobs because we basically, and we may have contact with our farmer customer several times a day at certain times a year, and certainly, countless times a year, if you're in an independent crop advising business or in a crop inputs retail business, right? We're contacting those farmers a lot, but the cumulative effect is, we grow one crop a year, right? So in my, what will probably be a 30 some odd year career, there's going to be 30 some odd customer buying experiences from Kenkura at BASF or, whoever working for whoever. And that's not a lot of experiences, right? So, we always say farmers have long memories, but the fact is they get to do this once a year, right?
True.
They get to grow this crop once a year. It's an annual cycle. One of the drawbacks of that is it seems to make life go fast, right?
Does, yeah.
Right.
It
Oh, there's
does.
another year gone. Believe me, it makes life go fast. But yeah, that's one of the things I've kind of noticed throughout my career. I think it's just really important that, we get into issue resolution, for example, because that was part of my job with Pride Seeds and now BASF is some troubleshooting, right? We've done that on your parents' farm. We've had to go out and look at some problems, resolve issues, whatever. It just there has to be a level of satisfaction from both parties, right? I have to leave the farm and say, have I got a satisfied customer or did I just make that issue go away? Have the satisfaction that we need. And likewise for the farmer, the farmer has to watch me walk out there, or drive out the driveway after that conversation and say, is that enough? Does that help me actually get past this issue? Right. And sometimes those issues, there's no resolution right here, right now. It's more or less, here's what we can do better next time, whether it's next year or the next field next week. But imparting that level of satisfaction. And you mentioned the term trusted advisor, and that's really key to strive to achieve that level as a certified crop advisor is to be that trusted advisor for the farmer. I mentioned they have long memories and as they should. And I've always told people that as growers get bigger and the equipment gets bigger and their capacity to get across land gets faster and faster and more efficient, their mistakes cover a lot of acres in a hurry. And as trusted advisors, we can't afford to position a mistake they're going to make,
That's a good
right?
point.
When they can put a sprayer across 1,200, 1,300 acres a day, when they can plant a 100-acre farm with a 24-row high speed in what an hour or something, like one mistake in planter setup and product selection, the wrong herbicide, right, for let's say follow cropping scenarios or whatever. Or even just the wrong rate of the right herbicide, man, those mistakes, they don't do it on a 32 and a half acre field anymore,
That's
right?
right.
They make a mistake, it goes across a lot of acres. And that's why those large growers really cherish their supplier rep relationships because they need that confidence and they need that support and they need that peace of mind. And I think sometimes we undervalue peace of mind in what we do as crop advisors.
Well, and something that you mentioned as you were speaking there was, the kind of gist of it was looking at the whole picture. Right. And not getting too hung up on the marketing or what maybe you're supposed to say. And I would say that's something that I've noticed that you do a great job of. I think every spring I get an email about Aragon in my inbox, and I still need it, honest to goodness, because you only deal with the products once a season, right? And I'm sure on your end or on somebody else in that role, it might be easy to think, oh gosh, like here I am again, bombarding them with the same information as last year. So talk a little bit about doing that boring work, like continuing to do what is working and not getting hung up on the new and shiny.
Yeah, I'm that type of person that the new and shiny is interesting, but I always look to the early adopters and the innovators. You know, we've all seen that early adopter innovator curve, right? I always look towards them, and I have that respected group of farmers or agronomists that are doing something, right? That's innovative. That's a new practice. If there's a certain group that's gaining traction with that, I'm very interested. And until then, man, there's a lot of new and shiny out there trying to get our attention. And not just in ag, right? In every sector of the economy, there's new and shiny, and we have to separate the wheat from the chaff. The fact is the concepts in agriculture are still the same, right? We look at weed control, it's, the weed spectrum gets more challenging, but the principles that we maybe have gotten away from or strayed from or had things, tools in the toolbox like herbicide-resistant technologies that may have oversimplified things for us in the end. And sure enough, we've got issues that we're dealing with because Mother Nature adapts, right? We see different weeds, we see resistant weeds, et cetera. But the concepts, all that's happening really is the basic concepts are making a return. And we're selling in the herbicide business a lot of very old actives or herbicide ingredients along with some new ones, but the old ones still are the foundation of a lot of what we do, right? You mentioned Aragon, right? 10 plus years old, staple product, right? Like the atrazines of the world and the various group 15 chemistries, whatever. I mean, we're still working with the same things, and we're just trying to make sure we work with them the best way possible. The new and shiny is, yeah, we watch the adoption curve on that, and we really look to those people that are picking up those practices and really asking the probing questions of what benefits are you seeing from this? Right? Like I know the 40-minute PowerPoint presentation. I can see at a meeting on what you're doing, but tell me what this really means for you, right? When I have growers talk to me about adopting strip till and what it meant for iron and equipment overhead and labor overhead, right? And then in the same sentence say, well, now my labor needs to be more skilled. Even though I need fewer legs, I need more skilled labor, and that presents its own challenge. So this business is constantly evolving, right? Which is kind of cool because, again, we only get to do it once a year. So that's why we always say, man, this business changes fast, right? It
Yeah,
does.
absolutely. No, that's a great answer. One of the things that you touched on there, changing gears a little bit, just talking about some of the older chemistries. I want to ask this because I know that it is always a common question amongst farmers, but we see a lot of the same technology get repackaged and renamed and repurposed. It takes quite a while to come out with new chemistries. Do you want to speak to that process just a little bit, just to enlighten those that aren't familiar with it?
Yeah, so before I get into that, you mentioned, old actives or old products being brought out as new products in co-packs or mixes or whatever. But I guess earlier in my career, I'd be quick to throw darts at that. But the weed spectrum shift because of the things we do on the farm, the other practices we've adopted, and all of a sudden, maybe that pre-mix or tank mix or whatever of a 15-year-old and a 30-year-old chemistry is suddenly a great solution,
True,
right? And
true.
that's why those things come to market, right? Because some herbicide active ingredients, just they're never going to go away because they have so much broad spectrum activity and they're valuable and they're like to use the term resistant to resistance in the way that they're used properly when they're used properly, right? But getting on to the meat and potatoes of your question about new herbicide active ingredients, I mean it's a massive undertaking for the BASFs and Syngenta, Corteva, Bayers of the world and other developers, right? I mean there's a massive expense. I can't remember exactly what that expense is, but I mean we throw out numbers of 300 plus million dollars, right? To take a new synthetic molecule, right? A synthesized molecule in the lab, figure out what it's actually good for, and then it eventually ends up in a jug with carriers and adjuvants and surfactants and inert materials, and a farmer can put it through their own sprayer. And it can be a solution that provides them with an economic benefit, right? And that's a long path. That's 10 to 15 years, depending on the product. There's obviously a mountain of legal wrangling, and there's a mountain of science, right? You and I have both seen those pictures from chemical company presentations of that stack of paperwork that's now on a CD, but that stack of paperwork that is the submission paperwork, all the toxicology tests, the environmental tests, the persistence work. I mean, there's so much more than just, is this product reasonably safe when we put it on a weed and it kills it. I mean, the safety hurdles that companies like ours and others have to jump through to bring these products to market are absolutely massive. And I think the other thing we have to watch for, particularly, in Canada right now, and I think it's a worldwide thing, because this is just the nature of the world and how information travels, is we also have a political landscape in that regulatory complex as well, right? I feel in Canada we have a very, very good regulatory system for not just the introduction but the review of herbicides and pesticides in general in our ag marketplace, right? The PMRA under Health Canada, they review all those new actives and those new products, and they look at what companies like ours submit, and they, we either get approval or we get suggestions that we should tweak something, or we need to go back and fix something because we're not going to let this go, right? So that's the PMRA doing their job, but they also reassess, and not a lot of people know that, right? They reassess those products too, to make sure that over time, we're not having an accumulation in the environment that's going to have issues down the road, that the product is still safe for the farmer to use and for warehousing people to work around, things like that, right? There's a lot to it. There's a lot to it. And that's why, that's why they don't come out every day, right? It's hard to come up with new active ingredients. And that's why we're putting a lot more emphasis on these more holistic farming practices like cover crops, trying to encourage crop rotation, which in the area you're from and down south of there is tough, right? It's soybean country, but you know what? Needs always bring about innovation. And you and I both know some very innovative growers down there that their fathers never grew corn, and the boys and girls are growing corn.
For sure.
Right? They're finding a way. So yeah, innovation is brought about by needs. And but that commercialization of new products, it's a difficult hurdle, and we really need the political influence to be in check to allow the science to win the day and help our industry out and provide the industry with solutions down the road.
For sure. No, that's excellent insight. And yeah, there's so much to it that a lot of us just don't think about or aren't educated on. So it's good to have that insight. I want to switch gears a bit and talk about your woodworking, but first, you've got such great experience working in the ag industry. And I just want to ask, what would be a couple of suggestions that you would have for some new graduates or folks that are younger in their careers coming into the industry? And, maybe some of the common mistakes that you see of newer industry members and some advice that you'd have for them.
So I think the first two things that come to mind, and I alluded to it earlier, is be willing to pay the price. Ag retail needs people, and it's a great learning ground. It's a great proving ground. And, in a lot of other career fields, Michelle, like as a graduate, if you were told to go do a job and pay the price for 5 years, 8 years, get it under your belt, have some success there, and then all the doors are going to open to bigger and better things. Well, most fields, we'd all jump right through that hoop every day, right?
That's right.
So in ag, we need to do that too. And as I said, it's more than just the person, and their individual dedication. It's the support network around them, right? Their families, it has to fit their lifestyle, obviously, as well. I think that the second thing, I've kind of taken I'm at the stage of my career. I just turned 50 last year. I've got 20 plus years under my belt already, right? I think, 2023 is my 25th crop year in the business since 1998, if my math is right. So, I've kind of taken a look at, as I in my last two roles, as I've trained people like yourself, right, to and tried to become a trusted advisor for people like yourself, Michelle, and your coworkers at the time, and others in the industry. Is, I see people coming into the industry and going different directions. It's unfortunate that a lot of young people are leaving our industry in the supply channel. That's definitely a concern. I get talking to hiring managers across our industry, and I think I alluded to it earlier. One of the things that we've identified is, we get a little bit too hung up on the agronomy and the scientific teachings for young people. Supplier reps have people like me to teach people like you the agronomy, right? I'm not discounting what's learned at the University of Guelph or any of the ag colleges, but I think we get too focused on that's all you need to get into this business. And the people skills, the relationship skills, and particularly because we're in crop input supply, you and I, so the ability to have relationships, understand the investment and the ROI type implications and such, but really understanding the insights that our customers come back with as part of a relationship building tool, right? When a farmer says something, okay, what does this really mean, right? What does this mean for the operation? What's the benefit for the overall operation if I position the solution on the farm? And that quite often go beyond yield, et cetera, right? There's behind that farmer who's looking for a solution in this year's crop is a farmer with a strategic plan who wants to grow their business, whether it's adding on to the dairy barn, whether it's we need to bring another 1,000 acres into this cash crop operation to transition it to our son and daughter, or whatever. There's bigger pictures involved there. So what I'm really getting at, and I think I kind of alluded to this earlier as well with the summer intern that came out of the University of Western Ontario here in London, not an ag school. One of my pet projects is I'd really like to get into the ag schools to speak to some of those clubs, and the non-ag schools as well. So, whether there's some of those student clubs or study clubs at Ivy School of Business here in London, or just in the Western Business Program, or other schools across the province, right? We need to reach out because those hiring managers are saying, look, like we can teach people the agronomy. And then I was taught the agronomy, when I started at 26 years old, right? Didn't learn it in school. I was taught the agronomy. I picked it up as I went. It's the people skills and it's the business acumen. That's the term that hiring managers are coming back with is the business acumen, because this farming game right now, what input prices have done, right? The fertilizer prices, the land prices have been climbing for years at rates way beyond inflation, right? This is a poker game with a lot of stakes, and it takes a big buy-in. And it takes somebody with business acumen to deal with these crop producers and livestock producers now, because we still like to we admire the family farm, but man, the family farm has got a lot of moving pieces behind it now. And
Absolutely.
there's a lot of money moving around and a lot of stress and a lot of relationship management and a lot of ambition driving those farm plans as well. So how do we fit into that as supplier reps? And it takes some business acumen and definitely a high degree of relationship skills and the ability to develop them. So that's a really long answer with two key points, but those are my thoughts on what I would talk to young people about right now, because I really feel that we need to get outside of the ag box when it comes to student recruiting. I spoke to the University of Guelph Soil and Crop Club back in the fall, and right now it looks like half of them are going back to farm versus 7 years ago when I spoke to them, and 10% of them were maybe going back to farm.
Yeah, that's a high percentage. Wow.
Yeah, and maybe it's not quite half, but I know when I asked, and by the way, they're historically a small class right now. They're historically as small as the mid and late 90s classes at Guelph, and a much higher percentage of them are going back to the farm. They weren't even looking for summer jobs. They were going back to the farm this summer. Man, that's a scary indication if you're a hiring manager or recruiter to see that response in that room. Maybe more of them will end up in ag. Question is for how long before they go back to the farm, right? We need to look at other sources of recruitment and sources of talent,
Well,
and I'd like to be involved in that.
It's very interesting you say that, and I do think you are an excellent person to be involved with that, especially because you have the communication skills to be able to portray what is involved in working in our industry and what skills are going to make you successful. But it is interesting that you bring up that point. The last podcast interview that I did was with Premier Equipment's marketing team, and their head of marketing said the exact same thing that when they do get folks applying or working for them that are, with an agricultural background, quite often it's 5 or 10 years, and then they're heading back to the farm. So they're doing the same thing, right? Where they're looking outside of agriculture to try and bring in talents. And in doing that, I've always thought that agriculture is unique in that we kind of glorify the hustle culture, in all honesty.
Yes.
And that's fine, and that's been fine. But I think that, this kind of new generation that's coming into the workforce, they're looking for something a little bit different. And I don't know if that's something that you've noticed or that you can speak to, but it's something that I kind of feel. And I mean, as a millennial, right, I can say that, right? I think that people are looking for a little bit more work-life balance now.
Yeah, we're seeing employers, including our own, that's trying to provide their employees with a better work experience. And that's really key. And that comes down to retention, right? And you talk about the younger generation of workers such as yourself, downtime and recognition are a huge deal. And it's really hard to get downtime
It
in
is.
agriculture at key times. Recognition, yeah, that's totally on the employer's plate. Right, dude, that's totally in your court and controllable. But when the weather, it doesn't rain for we don't get a 2 or 3 day rain, 2 or 3 day rain stretch in a spring like last spring, and we work for 100 plus days in a row in crop inputs retail. That's hard to manage. Like, and then the downtime aspect is hard to manage, but it's critical. So I mean, yeah, employers are looking at their overall compensation package beyond the wage, beyond the pension, the benefits, and looking at how do we create a better work experience for our employees. I'm really happy I work for BASF and a company that is consistently ranked high in those lists you hear about of Canada's top 50 or top 100 employers. But I can tell you as an employee, it seems like a lot of kind of orbiting stuff at the time when you're a new hire at BASF, but then you really start to learn what it means to you as an employee. And we're appreciative of it, right? And whether a big corporation like us or a small family-owned business in ag, yeah, everybody's looking at that retention aspect, and I think it's going to become pretty critical going forward. I can also tell you, as in my time as on the Certified Crop Advisor Association, I've just finished, I think, 9 or 10 years on the board. I can't remember. I spent my 6 years on the executive. This was also a need we identified, right, as a group of CCAs doing our strategic planning there back in 2019, is we have a talent gap now, and it's only going to get worse going forward. So we need to encourage our employers to look at the retention tools that are available to provide a better employee experience and still be able to allow the business to function and get the job done. And
Great.
I think COVID's taught us a few tools that maybe we didn't think we had available too, right? The virtual world and the reduced face-to-face contact that the pandemic brought out.
Yep.
I think our industry, along with several others, have discovered some efficiencies. I know I have.
Yes.
And if those efficiencies are beneficial for our customers, beneficial for the employer, and beneficial for the employee, well, then we should be pursuing them.
Absolutely. It's kind of forced us to that next step that some other industries were already at, right? No, that's excellent insights for sure, and absolutely appreciate you sharing that. Let's switch gears a bit. And one of the big reasons that I wanted to have you on this podcast and was excited to chat with you is because I've been following along with what you've been doing with your woodworking business, K&K Wood Co. For those who aren't familiar, you make the most beautifully handcrafted wood and epoxy resin, you know, furniture, you've got tables, cutting boards, everything in between. And so I want to spend the next, you know, 20 minutes or so chatting
sure.
about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you probably see from the look on my face, I'd like to chat about that. Enough about work. Enough about work today, right? Come on, let's go.
Exactly. Well, it's funny, like, I was actually thinking about it because I was, you had sent me some photos beforehand and I was looking through your social media, kind of thinking about some questions, and came across a couple photos from some of the trade shows that you've attended. And, you know, I've been to a couple vendor setups with my small business over the last year, and you know, I know what it's like to feel like a beginner all over again. And I'm a little bit younger than you are, not as established in my career. And so that was actually the first thing I wanted to ask, like, you know, how does it feel? I mean, I know that you're into this a couple of years now, but what's it been like to kind of start something new and be a bit of a beginner again?
Yeah, you get to learn all over again. So not just the technical aspect of it, right? You know, because we spend a lot of money on wood and a lot more money on resin.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't lie to you, it doesn't always go well, right? As we speak right now, there's $50 of resin that leaked out of a form and it's on my garage floor last night.
Oh, so, no.
And this is not the first time, right? I have this wonderful mosaic of pigmented resin spills on my cement garage floor. So maybe by the time K&K Woodco folds up and is done and hopefully 10 years or whatever, or my boy takes it over, the garage floor will be an epoxy floor. It'll all be random. There's a lot of learning involved there. You know, the technical aspect, but also the business aspect, which people may see, you know, they might find it odd that I say that, but, not every business is the same. Right. And, this has forced me to get out of my ag box a little bit and the way we think about that business. And now we're into things that are handcrafted, handmade, deeply personal, some of them. I think you can tell from some of those pieces, the pictures I sent you, right? They're deeply personal and sentimental. So you have that. That's kind of in your mind while you're making them, right? And when you get into these, and this is part of our tagline with the K&K business, is, you know, one of a kind, right?
Yes.
So it's a one of a kind product. But even just learning the business aspect of it. I mean, the craft show I did in London, I did a 4-day craft show in London at the Agriplex. So if any farm customers are watching, that's where they hold the London Farm Show, right in that building. So big show, 4 days, learned a pile about my customer base, like who my prospective customer base is and where my opportunities are.
Mm-hmm.
Because the woodworking thing and the live edge and resin thing is a vastly saturated market. There are a pile of garage warriors doing it just like I am. The one really cool thing, there's a lot of women doing it.
Interesting.
And that's awesome to see. You know, it's typically, oh, the shop is a man's place.
Yeah.
Right. Band-aids and duct tape and electrical tape. I think the women hurt themselves a lot less in their shops, and they make great stuff. And I think that comes down to the attention to detail. And I think they know something that I don't, because I've really had to rely on my wife as my decor expert, as Mandy has an eye for interiors and decor. I'm a man. I'm not an artist, and I don't have an eye for this gray goes with this blue or whatever the heck you want to call it, right? Or this is going to be my splash of color. I'm like, I don't know. That's all foreign language to me. Mm-hmm. I'm picking it up as I go. I've learned what colors I need to make more of as far as inventory pieces, etc. But yeah, there's been a lot of learning. It's very, very different than ag, that's for sure.
No kidding. So how long, you've had this business going for the last, 2 years now, kind of maybe a bit longer since the start of COVID?
Yeah, start of COVID, basically, because I was like everybody else when we got sent home on Friday, March 13th.
Yeah.
Right? It was like, okay, we get to go home. Wow, we kind of knew it was coming for like a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then we might get sent home tomorrow, and we got warnings that morning that we were probably getting sent home, and we got sent home. And we all had a chance to digest things, and I'll be honest, we did what most other people did. We ran to the liquor store because we were, you know, hey, we're going to be home for 2 weeks. Let's just chill out. This is kind of a stressful time and our kids are going to drive us nuts. Doesn't matter what age they are. They're going to drive us nuts. And, you know, well, the wife and I are going to be home. So we're going to reconnect and try to make some fun of this. That wears off after a couple of weeks, right? Because 2 weeks to flatten the curve turned into what it turned into.
Yes.
And but we, to get back to the to where that led to woodworking, is we needed a new kitchen table at the time. And I had stumbled across these posts on Instagram from quite a few suppliers, right? Jeff Max Supply in Mississauga being one of them. There's several others, and absolutely fantastic follows from both sides of the border in Canada and in the States. And the best thing I can say about the Instagram crafting community and woodworking community, they've been very, very good about sharing their process.
Nice.
Whether it's by DM or just in public posts. And the good ones share their mistakes, right? They overshare. But yeah, it was easy to glean information from them and then just use the principles and what I hope is a little bit of inherent intelligence in between my ears to actually do this right. So my first pour was, I spent $400 on a maple slab that was kind of cool and wormy and had a knot hole in it and whatever. I split it down the middle and okay, we're committed now, and $1,100 worth of resin went in it. So just a mild, you know, dip your toe in the water for your first project, right?
No kidding, eh?
Let's put $1,700 to work, right? And
it's going to sit in the middle of your house, the focal point of your house.
Yeah. And it looks great. That was done with my old sander, and you can tell. My best ROI has been my $2,200 sanding machine. It just, you know, you still have to have the talent and the eye for the finish, but man, that machine gets me there.
Nice.
Right. So that new that old table, now that 2.5-year-old table, is going to be refinished here this winter, and it will look spiffy and new again. But yeah, that's how I got into it. Is it was a COVID hobby, and then I made a couple things on spec, and boom, I'm for a part-time gig, I think I'm almost 270 to 300 customers deep now.
Wow, that's incredible. Good for you.
Yep, it's been fun.
So did you had you done much or any woodworking prior to that? Or this was just, I've seen people make tables like this, I'm going to try it.
My woodworking experience was, my uncle's wood lathe sat in the shop at home on the farm, and I fiddled around with it and had some fun. I mean, one of my projects in the old farmhouse, when we renovated the upstairs, is, of course, way back in the day, lead paint was a thing, and that stuff went on like an eighth of an inch thick, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we had a, you know, we had the stairway up the center of the farmhouse, like those houses were all laid out, right, to get to the upstairs. And it had a L-shaped handrail around it, right? Safety rail with the balusters all turned and everything. It's like, we should refinish that, because it had like a, don't be offended, but an ugly cream color. As I mm-hmm. I just said that as I was looking at your background there, but that's about
the color. Sorry. I didn't pick the color or anything.
give me a minute while I yank my foot out of my mouth. And so as it turned out, I stripped it down with a heat gun, and it had like 8 layers of different colors on it, and underneath was the most beautiful, rich, old growth dark cherry.
Nice.
Good. This was like, so that was one of my big projects, was to put all those spindles on the lathe and
mm-hmm.
tidy them up and refinish them and refinish the handrail and the main spindle post. But and then high school and elementary school woodworking, you know, we worked on lathes, we built little side tables, you know, that was our project, things like that. So I mean, I always liked it.
Mm-hmm.
But just kind of saw this and had time on my hands because of the pandemic, and then saw an opportunity to teach my now 15-year-old son a few things about not just making things, but dealing with people at trade shows.
Yep.
Which he's getting very good at. Obviously the technical of making the thing, but also making something that people want, right? Mm-hmm. The customer has given us this vision, and now we have to fulfill it. And then the business acumen that comes with it too, understanding your costs, understanding the labor and time involved, and how you want to be paid.
That's excellent. And that's incredible, because I mean, like, your work is beautiful. Like, from somebody on the outside, right, I would think that you have spent years crafting your skills. So, and just to paint a picture for the people that are listening, a lot of your products are, they're live edge. They're very unique pieces of wood. So you pick pieces that have character and that have got some dips and divots and holes in them that you fill with beautiful sparkling colors of epoxy. and sometimes various objects. So we've had fishing lures, I've seen wine corks. What else? What are some of the unique things that you filled in the epoxy resin?
Yeah, done a few things with wine corks. You mentioned the fishing lure one, which was a custom build for a retirement gift for an old high school friend of mine. Actually, I hadn't run into her since basically the day we left high school in what was grade 13, back when grade 13 was a thing. It was actually Scholastic and not a victory lap, right? And what have we done? We've done in my background here, grain. So I have my BSF and CCA logo. I'm halfway through an office renovation. That's why things are just piled up on the shelf on the wall eventually. But I've done a couple things with grains. Did one for farm family in Tavistock that was cherry slabs that their late father had milled years ago, and I built a table with the four grains that they grow on the farm.
Nice.
That was a very meaningful project, and got some nice notes from the family after, which is really fantastic. One of the things that I am going to work on, and shameless plug here, I'm hoping to have them ready for the John Deere Two Cylinder Club show in Paris. They have a show in Woodstock, Princeton, sorry, area every year. It bounces between two farms, but it's the John Deere Two Cylinder show. So a lot of John Deere collector enthusiasts. But we're going to take some walnut and maple hollow cookie rounds and make coffee tables out of them, but I'm hoping I have enough wood to work with there and enough depth to actually build a farm scene with die cast miniatures
Beautiful.
in there. So
Wow.
one of a kind farm theme coffee tables. They might have some grains in them. I'm not sure what I'm going to get into there yet, but those will be ready by August, because I actually booked my space for that show today and promised them I'd have that stuff. So I guess I know what I'm doing between now and then. What
You
else?
go.
Build a board for the Precision Skating Club coach at Tavistock last year at Christmas. They won a really prestigious competition up in Quebec, and the parents and the girls on the team commissioned that build, just a small board with a figure skating blade in it and some pictures of the girls doing what girls do, right? Great pictures, selfies, all that, of the team, their medals. Things that have a high degree of sentimental value, right? And
Yeah.
again, very unique.
No
So,
kidding, eh?
yeah.
That's very neat. Do you have a favorite piece of all time that you've created for someone?
I don't know that I do. I have a short list of ones that, and I think the reason I remember them is the reactions. I think I showed you the walnut table with the horseshoes on the bench at Knowles, and I mean, that, a very cherished friend of mine, Chrissy, when I gave that to her, like, she's, sorry, Chrissy, I'm going to throw you under the bus, but in tears, right? With the reaction. And another friend who I built a Lake Erie dining table. So this is a CNC carved lake map of Long Point Bay, right? Really, really highly detailed, very cool piece. I don't have the CNC machine, but I'm fortunate I have a CNC person that's really talented and knows how to maximize that machine and its capabilities. And build a beautiful tabletop for her, and it was a complete surprise. So when we hiked it in and took the blanket off of it, it's just like speechlessness for about 3 or 4 minutes. And yeah, it's the reactions, because to go back to agriculture, when we resolve issues, whether it's an easy issue and we're just supporting a farmer's activity, so making something good better, or whether we have a real problem and we've dealt with some pretty sensitive and expensive issues over the years trying to settle those up, right? And I think, we leave that satisfied. The farmer leaves that satisfied, but they don't, let's hope they don't leave it in tears with satisfaction, right? That's not the satisfaction level that we get in our day-to-day lives as crop advisors, right? It's a more of a business sense of satisfaction and relationship satisfaction. And yep, that's what we needed here. That met the needs of the business and my needs emotionally for that decision, et cetera, et cetera. But when I Yeah, this woodworking thing, I think that's been the release, is it's being able to go out there and work with my hands and have a vision in my head, but then the reactions are just,
Yeah.
Wow, right?
I think a lot of times, like a lot of what we have to do, whether we think it is or not, we enjoy the relationships that we build and the human interaction, right? And I think a lot of times that's why we do what we do. What has like what have you learned about people or about relationships or about yourself during this? Gonna get all
Yeah,
hippie
no, it's all good.
here, but
First of all, I've learned I'm still not an artist, and you won't believe that, but I'm not. Like, I'm not. I mean, I still can't draw anything more than a stick person, right? I have wood and resin, and I can come up with a vision. I can look at the wood, and I can do that. But I've been asked about, quoting out more artistic pieces, some of the other things you see on Instagram, the beach art, for example. So for anybody that doesn't understand what that is it's some of the work that I do, but what they do is they layer, they install the resin in layers, and they'll adhere in like beach sand, beach gravel, beach stone. Go to the craft store and get pebbles, get fake cactus, fake ivy, fake little shipwreck ships, things like that. You could hand me all that, and I can't put that vision in my head of what that needs to look like against a piece of wood and resin and make it work. This is not my skill set. So you learn your capabilities and what you're capable of and what you're not. There's obviously the business acumen there. I would love to have three or four more key tools in my garage. Number one is space and electrical capacity, but I can cross those hurdles sometime. But the big thing is you still got to make the money on the pieces to pay for the tools, especially when it's a side gig, right? This is not a build it and they will come type scenario like Field of Dreams. Like you have to walk as fast as the money basically comes in, and work comes in. So that's very key, is to not, and that would be a key piece of advice for anybody thinking about a side gig, is do not overextend yourself and do not operate under any assumptions, especially in today's economy, because money's getting tight out there. And I think I've also learned the value of uniqueness. That's a big one. So not to get into a long story, but I had another Lake Erie coffee table that I built on spec as the same time as the other one I mentioned. And there was an opportunity to make some pretty nice money on that. And the big thing is there's an opportunity to sell it to somebody who Long Point Bay, for those of you that don't know, North Shore of Lake Erie, southeast of Tillsonburg, south of Simcoe. Piles and piles and piles of cottages, trailers, park model homes, boating on the bay, Potahawk weekend, right? Like it's a big deal. The bay is a huge summer recreation hub. And there's a lot of sentimental attachment to the bay. And so I built that table. It took a long time to find a customer for that. And I was just about ready to discount it and blow it out. And I took it to the London show because of my experience with Pride Seeds and BSF. We always talk about setting up for a trade show. What stops people at the booth, right? And we learned at that trade show that we need to stop people at that booth for 30 seconds. Then we have a chance at a sale, right? Because that 30 seconds is enough to prevent kind of the flyby or the walk by, right, at your booth. So what I did is I put that Long Point Bay coffee table right out front because I knew that would catch eyes, right? And that made people stop at the booth. I don't know how many thousand people were through that show in 4 days, but on the Sunday morning, we sold it out of the blue. I have absolutely no expectations to sell that table at that show. All it was an attraction. And on Sunday morning, a lady walked through and she looked out and she's like, that's really nice. Well, she was about the 8,000th person to say that in 4 days, right? She's like, our family is from that area. I'm like, oh yeah, tell me more, right? Good salesman, open-ended question, right? And she talked about her family's immigration history in the 1800s into Massachusetts, and I believe as Empire loyalists in Belleville before they settled in Port Rowan area on the bay. Her family has since all left that area, all gone their separate ways. Kids are married and starting families and moved away. She came back 5 minutes later, and that was a really cool story. She came back 5 minutes later, bought the table. She's like, yeah, I'll take it. And it was the last kind of sentimental attachment. Her daughter, I believe, was renovating or putting an addition on her and her husband's house. And that was their attachment to the bay because that was, I believe, probably the last generation to kind of full-time live down there. And the bay was the main source of recreation in the summer. So the lesson there, Michelle, is if you build truly unique stuff, or if you have a truly unique special offering, regardless of what you're supplying to the marketplace, woodwork, whatever, right? If it's truly unique, if you have a big enough crowd, there's a buyer somewhere. And more importantly, there's a buyer at the price you need to get to make it worthwhile, right? To have value for the buyer and for the seller. There's a buyer in that crowd. So that show was really high value for me. It's not a cheap show to get into, but to have that many eyes going through the show, I was building unique pieces and they weren't selling. And all of a sudden I go to a show where there's just that many people coming through and the prospective buyers were in there.
Well,
So
I think
you have to get out in front of people, right?
there's a lot of good lessons to unpack there. I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts and stuff in the business space, and something that I have found to really ring true for me and what I'm trying to do is that, it's always more work involved than what you think there is going to be. And it's always going to take longer. You always need more volume in order to get the sales or get the reactions that you're hoping for. I think we underestimate the work involved to make things happen. And so that's a good testament to you that, how many people had stopped by and said, "Oh, that's really nice," and you were ready to discount it. And then there you go. On the Sunday, you made the sale. So I think that that's a good point.
Hold your ground. And part of that too is not being overinvested in the business, right? Finance, especially as a side gig, you have to be smart about it, right? I mean, we're a household here with two incomes, raising the kids, and we have payments to make and everything else. I mean, you have a responsibility to your household to make sure the side gig isn't a drain, and not just a drain on finances, but a drain on time.
Totally.
The other part too is you have to have support there, and I'm fortunate that Mandy supports it, provided I don't drag too much sawdust into the house because the noise you hear is the vacuum running around upstairs. But you need support there, and I think in your mind too, you really have to understand where this is going to go. I've gotten a lot of suggestions from other vendors. Oh, you should go to this show in Toronto or something like that, and I'm like, my core is my time in my ag career. I still need my job in my ag career. This side gig could never replace it unless I had a whole bunch of investment capital come in from somewhere to build bigger and better and have more capacity, things like that. So I mean, Ken Cura, the BASF rep, isn't going anywhere, right? I mean, I still enjoy this job and it's still a staple in my life. So you have to go about these side ventures and really understand what's the most you can put into them. And what's the most you can extract and make of them, if that makes any sense? And how does that all fit together into your life?
Well, and like you kind of said before, like it's a release for you, like you're getting fulfillment from this in a different way than your career with BASF, right? And that's worth something as well.
Yeah, but I think when I look back at how this all started, right? And I mentioned how COVID started and you have a 2 week phase where the liquor table is full, and then say, okay, that's not going to last as long as the pandemic's going to last, apparently. I had ideas on, I would do a bunch of reading. I have a stack of self-help books up there, and half of them are unread, right? But just general interest books on business or sports or whatever. And I learned that I just can't be that type of person that reads until they're tired, has a nap, and can't wait to pick up the book next day. That's not me. I need to work with my hands. That's me. I need to work with my hands, and that's what I learned, and that's what I like about it. So it's been a lot of fun, and kind of looking forward now that I have a bit of intelligence on what that market is going to look like in a declining economy. To be cautious not to get overinvested, but also understand that there's still a need out there. Still a need, and there's still a market that really, really wants that high value, sentimental piece, right? When I build a big 4x8 hard maple and blue resin dining table last May, that's theirs, right? They're putting an addition on their farmhouse right now. That table is theirs. I can make one like it, but I can't build that one. Right, it is their table. It is truly unique to them, and that's what I say to my customers when I drop off a piece of furniture is I hope you cherish that for a long time because they wanted a handmade item, right?
Yes. Oh, and they will. Absolutely. And then, I mean, yeah, in a declining economy, but I'm sure now, kind of going into this for your third or fourth season, you've probably learned the seasonalities out of it. I think before I started recording, we were chatting about, you've got some projects on the go and then starting to get ready for Christmas again. So, as you get further along in this journey, you'll kind of learn those trends too, right?
Yeah, exactly. You kind of go with the flow and use what you've learned to fine tune your activities around the business and then making it
Yeah.
fit your real job and your real world at home, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, that's well, I love that. And I love following along with your journey. For people that are listening, where can they find you on social media to follow along with you?
Yeah, so right now I have a Facebook and YouTube, or sorry, Facebook and Instagram dedicated page, K&K Wood Company. It'll note Ken and Son Kiefer in there. We're located in Northeast London. We work out of a garage that's too small, like everybody's workshop. It's too small, and yeah, you can catch me there. Debating a YouTube channel just to show my process, but at the same time, that I noticed that that's a full-time maker's thing. Right. And as you can attest, it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort to put those types of things together. So not sure on the YouTube channel. I do have a website, K&K Wood Wood Company. And yeah, we're in the process of revamping that. We were trying to sell on that page, but we're actually going with other vectors. Basically, if somebody's interested, they can just watch me. I post as I build on Instagram and Facebook. So quite often I'll be building something and I get a note and somebody says, "Hey, I want to see that when it's done." So that is officially a lead, right? And yeah, that's where I'm at, is the website and Facebook and Instagram mainly. And yeah, best place is Instagram.
Yes. No, and it's I love watching the process, and I'm excited to see what you continue to come out with. I think honestly that we covered a lot of the things that I wanted to talk about, and even some of the questions that I had that I was thinking about along the way. I think you covered them all. Is there anything that you would like to speak to that I didn't ask today?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground today. I think it's just really important for regardless, because we've talked about Ken's real job and we've talked about Ken's kind of side gig and side passion now, right? And it's just really important for an individual in those situations to, whether it's a real job or whether it's, another pursuit like that, you really do have to have a plan. You really do have to have and that plan revolves around, the financial and the time and the people aspect of it, right? That's a big thing, is making sure you have a plan, you have contingencies to the plan, right? The what ifs are covered, and you understand your opportunities and your limitations. Because we've alluded to the economy a couple times. Well, it's certainly not any cheaper to borrow money.
No.
So if you're borrowing money to get into your side gig, you have to have a plan, right? Those types of things. And let's face it, for a lot of people, we've been in a low interest rate period for so long that this is new to them. Like, actually, where interest costs are a burden and a significant impact on profitability, this is a new experience for a lot of people. We haven't seen this for 10 years.
Totally.
So yeah, just having that plan in place, understand your opportunity, understand your limitations. Don't be too optimistic and don't sell yourself short either. And be willing to listen, people. And you mentioned podcasts earlier. So make sure you have this network of things that are kind of orbiting around you that you can garner information from. One of the things I've taken to recently, never watched it before, but Shark Tank.
Yes.
Because I love the drill down aspect of Shark Tank, right? You've got the people making the pitch. But then to watch how all the sharks behave, right? They're getting down to brass tacks quick, and obviously it's edited for TV, but they really force the prospect that's making the pitch to know a few key things. And obviously the question on what's your cost, what's your margin percentage, what's your committed sales, what's your cost to acquire customers? So in other words, they're asking what your marketing's costing. And then you get Mark Cuban, who's sitting there looking at you with a funny look on his face, and says, "What do you need?" And that's a horrible question to the beginner, but then, to somebody with business acumen, he's challenging this prospect to be like, do you really understand where you're going with this? Because my money's not going for the ride with you unless you have a plan and you understand what you're doing in your business and you understand what you need versus what you want. Ken would love a 52-inch wide sander planer and the hydro to feed it. I can't justify that, and I'm 10 years away from justifying that, right? You have to understand that my next want is like a 15-inch $1,000 planer that will give me an efficiency to fuel my side gig and my plans going forward, right? So yeah, Shark Tank has been, that's been a bit of an eye opener for me because they really do make the prospects understand the business basics, and I think they remind a lot of those prospects on Shark Tank, is your plan really solid, number one? And number two, like, are you fully confident in it? Like, are you fully confident and are you fully prepared move forward to where you think you want to go? Right. I just, that's one of the things I really, really enjoy. And I've been watching on TV lately because I glean a lot from it.
I love that. That is excellent advice. Fantastic. And good to ask yourself those hard questions.
Yeah, for sure.
That's good. Well, thank you so much for sharing not only insight and wisdom from your career in the ag sector, but also on this amazing side hustle that you have. And I really do encourage folks to follow along with what you're doing because, again, it is beautiful work, and I just think that it's a really cool journey to watch.
No, that's awesome. Thank you, Michelle. And I love your compliments. I love everybody's compliments. It's we put a lot into this, and including $50 of epoxy on the floor occasionally. And we love to hear the compliments, and yeah, the likes on our social media are appreciated.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. For updates to new episodes, please subscribe or follow me on Twitter at Michelle_Dernan.